Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and this week on the Roundup, we're going to be covering three important questions that we've been hearing international educators asking this past week. We're going to get to those in just a minute or two, but first want to give a particular shout out to all of you who are watching live on Facebook each Wednesday at 1 p.m. It's a pleasure being here with you, connecting with you each day, each week, and discussing the issues of the day, and really getting some feedback from you on how these ideas and these topics are impacting what you do in your work. So very keen to get your feedback today as we go through these three major questions we've been experiencing this past week. Some of them are new spins on the same topics. But so looking forward to hearing what you have to say and how this might be impacting you. So let's get right to it. We are obviously in a very important time in the school year, with new academic year starting in full at many colleges and universities around the country. Some have been open for a week or two. Others are just starting this week or early next week. And we're seeing what many will call a train wreck happening, and it's hard to look away. Back in the early spring, when COVID was first starting to take effect, we saw a lot of what's happening now. People were talking about, oh, by the fall we'll be fine. We're going to plan to be fully in person. A lot of universities made very bold predictions to that effect, and we're seeing the results of that kind of a strategy laid bare before the world, with so many colleges this week that had gone fully in person now deciding to, because of huge spikes in COVID cases with new students coming back on new and returning students coming to campus, off-campus parties, all of these wonderful things that typically happen in a college year that have led to a number of colleges so far that had opened in person going fully online already because of these spikes in cases. We'll get to some of those specific questions in a little bit in our second question, but I want to get to the implications first of what COVID has done to our profession, particularly international admissions, when we talk about how we are connecting with future students and talking about how we live our daily lives from our home offices now. I've had my own home office for 4 years since we moved here to Findlay, Ohio. I've really spent a lot of time in my business, obviously with working with individual colleges and other service providers, dealing with the kinds of issues of virtual meetings and virtual recruitment. So this is something that is not old hat, but certainly something I'm very comfortable with. And having an approach towards international recruitment these days has to involve some sort of virtual means like Zoom. So many of you have experienced Zoom fatigue already since that first boomed onto the market in the early spring. But the question of what is your Zoom game like these days is acknowledging a couple things. First, the changed reality of how recruitment is going to be done for the next year. And likelihood is that not just this fall, but more than likely the spring as well, will be a time in our world's history where there isn't a whole lot of international travel going on, and international schools that you might go visit, international fairs, large gatherings of people from multiple areas is not something that's going to be a regular occurrence for some time to come. So using this kind of a tool, a Zoom game, is really really an important piece of your overall puzzle, whether it's Zoom or another platform. It's just I'm using that as an example. Obviously, we're not on Zoom today. We're using Facebook as our platform to reach you, but we can repurpose Zoom videos in other formats as well. And this is something that I'm dealing with personally with an organization I'm doing recruitment tours and events for, United World Colleges, There has been physical recruitment tours that I originally was going to be doing this September that some of you who I know well have been aware of, that these were going to be tours to schools in Europe and Asia throughout September, visiting 14 different schools and taking group of about 10 to 15 U.S. colleges around to those schools. Back in April, it became pretty clear we would not be able to fully subscribe those tours because people weren't committing. And because the realities of what we're seeing now is that international travel, recruitment travel, is not a reality that we're going to be seeing anytime soon. So people had to look for alternatives. And when we quickly pivoted to on the recruitment side, these same schools are not going to be having visitors, physical visitors, to their campuses around the world this year. So how are schools in the U.S. going to be reaching them? And obviously virtual fairs is something I've had experience with going back to my days at Ball State University in Indiana in 2005 and 6 when we arranged these through our state consortia, Destination Indiana. We did the first live video college fairs with a group of Middle Eastern Education USA advising centers our first year in 2005 and again in 2006 and spread that in other areas as well as a way to give our members institutions in Destination Indiana an opportunity to connect with prospective students around the world, in particular these Middle Eastern Education USA advising centers. So that was how we first started out back in early 2005 with an event geared specifically to recruit international students through virtual means. I'd be on one end of my computer or video conferencing software that would allow me to show a video to maybe demonstrate a website that was important for our audiences to see. Technology has evolved some since then, 15 years ago, that we now find ourselves in an environment where there are multiple platforms that students and institutions can use to reach each other and connect. But things that, if you haven't been doing them significantly as part of your previous recruitment strategies as it relates to international students, if you haven't already been practicing a lot with the technology, with the tools that are available to you, there's more of a chance for missteps and some lessons learned maybe from those that have been doing it a while. When it comes to Zoom, there's a couple of articles that I'll be sharing here in a minute. One from Inside Higher Ed this past week that talks about roadrunners don't Zoom and maybe kind of makes a little over-the-top call on how doing your entire recruitment this fall via Zoom is not going to be a productive way to do what you do. Certainly, it shouldn't be the only thing, but certainly things like Zoom or virtual meetings that's through whatever platform do need to be an essential part because you do still need to connect with your student audiences. Personally, either you and or your student workers and or current students on campus, faculty, whoever it might be, are still going to want those opportunities to connect with future students. And that's something that you want to provide the opportunities for to your target audiences, whether it's your on-campus audiences or your prospective audiences. They need to be having these virtual connections since the physical ones won't be possible. International admissions folks are already a little bit more geared towards this already because there are many colleges, in fact, the majority of colleges in the United States do not do overseas recruitment. And they have to rely on what I've and many have called in the business a traditional armchair recruitment to bring in their students, international students to their campuses. Aside from the colleges that have relied heavily on recruiting international students within the United States, where there's a domestic population that is well over 100,000, 150,000 almost international students that are currently in the United States studying either at high schools, English language programs, community colleges, that may be a potential market for U.S. institutions. We've talked about that before, but aside from those groups that have these domestic international audiences already, you have to rely on armchair means because you're not going to be getting physically to all these countries around the world where the students might be that you want to recruit. So you have to rely on virtual means. You have to rely on partners in country and those types of things. But these virtual connections, these virtual tools to reach those audiences, are absolutely critical now more than ever to a successful international enrollment strategy. And another useful article I got a kick out of is how to curate your Zoom background and why is that important. It's written from the perspective of faculty and how they teach their classes, but relying on their own experiences in using Zoom and in large meetings when there might be a faculty meeting and having 20 people in a virtual room, and it's like a huge Brady Bunch on steroids kind of environment. You see what people are using for their backgrounds for these meetings. And the author of the article, a faculty member, posts some very makes some very interesting comments about people's backgrounds. 10 bags of kitty litter behind them, or dirty dishes on the shelf behind them, or some other kind of obscure things that kind of distract attention from what the goal of the meeting is. And certainly, if you're presenting, paying attention to this. If you're recording something. For this, these virtual fairs that I'm doing for United World College institutions, secondary schools, I had the universities do a 1 to 3 minute, or 1 to 2 minute, actually 90 second to 1 2 minute elevator pitch videos. And some of them got really creative, got their MarCom team involved, and were able to shoot different scenes of campus, probably some footage they already had, but also had some interviews with either faculty members that worked with UWC students, current students who went to UWC schools, those types of things, and had some personal connection that I asked and suggested, hey, make this video your opportunity to connect with these students before they come to you on the day of the fair. And the schools that we'll be doing the virtual events for, they're passing this playlist of these videos out to their students, and to give them kind of a preview of what institutions are going to be at the live events. And some of the backgrounds that some people did it very professionally, had their MarCom people involved. Some did a very simple, almost slideshow of images as they did a voiceover with their video up. Talking about their campus and how their campuses are one of the best places for students that go to UWC students, and making personal appeals, and did really well with that. Others just had them doing a video of themselves through Zoom, recording it through Zoom, and just had a plain wall in the background. I mean, I guess if that's all you can have, that's all you can have. But I made the suggestion have a pennant or a table banner that you might use at a college fair. Have that on as a backdrop for you, something to allow a visual connection with your institution and you speaking, so that when the student sees your video, they can make that connection and so on. Some schools did it. Some U.S. colleges took advantage of that advice. Some didn't. And some people cut their heads off when they were doing their videos. You only see like from their forehead down. To just below their chin. Others just had some bad lighting. So there are things that you really need to pay attention to when you're doing these kind of virtual meetings. I'm fortunate enough with this backdrop here. When I knew I was going to be doing these midweek roundups a couple of years ago, I invested in a professional photo backdrop frame that I could drape these kinds of images over. That's a real backdrop of an old map. I've got a few others that I use on occasion for different events. But paying attention to these kinds of things, the attention to the detail, that is really important, I think, as you, if you're going to use virtual tools, whatever the platform may be, Zoom or otherwise, is making sure that it represents well and there aren't a lot of distractions other than what you have in your backdrop. That you see these folks that get interviewed on TV now have these significant bookshelves with books that they've written and positioning on these things. So you see that they've actually spent some time thinking about what that needs to look like. So it's interesting to see how people do or do not maximize their opportunities for exposure when it comes to live events like this. So I say that with a little bit of a tongue in cheek when I talk about some of the things that I've seen that I certainly wouldn't do myself now. But That's why when you have these kind of events, midweek roundups, when we talk about these things, I make recommendations. And I really want to be a solutions-driven kind of resource for institutions and talking about the kinds of things that make sense for your campus and ways that you can use tools to maximize your impact with your prospective students. So that's where I'm coming from. As we talk through some of these issues, we oftentimes can get a little sidetracked on just going down some rabbit holes on topics, but really my focus always comes back to solutions. And when we go to the next question for this week, we talk about how can colleges reopen safely. Reopening it covers a lot of different things when you think about reopening. And we've been fortunate enough to have the Chronicle has had their own version of college reopening plans. They did their own for a while of input they were getting directly from institutions. Now they partnered with Davidson College in North Carolina to get a much broader perspective. Nearly 3,000 institutions are covered in this. On an ongoing basis, on where they are in the spectrum of fully in person to fully online and everywhere in between. So the fully in person numbers have been decreasing steadily, where they're at about 2.5%. So very few colleges are in that market. 20% now, according to this most recent list, it's updated daily, are primarily in person. And I wonder if that it may be even going down even further, as some of these other schools that we've seen, we alluded to in the intro, have already closed after less than a week to 10 days, already going back on fully online. So 20% are in that category as of Monday. Hybrid was 15%, primarily online, 27%, fully online, 6%. Still 24% TBA, so I'm really curious about that group and where they're going to fall. Certainly falling in the primarily online, at most hybrid at this point, is where I think the greater majority of institutions are going to end up. Now, as we've talked about over the last couple of weeks, this poses incredible challenges for new international students coming in because they already have the prohibition on online only for new international students. Returning students can be enrolled in online only, but new internationals cannot come into the United States for the first time and begin a fully online program. When they come to the border, this is what we talked about a little bit last week. If they were issued a visa at a time when their institution was still planning a hybrid or in person, and now they're gone in that interim three weeks before they get to campus, and they enter the United States right after their college has decided to go fully online, they are now technically should not be admitted to the United States. And I would guess the majority would be sent home if that issue comes up. And I don't think that CBP officers have a running list of those institutions and what their current policies are. I doubt they would. They're not that, most aren't that sophisticated in that regard, but they're certainly going to ask the question. So how are your studies going to be this fall? Are you taking in-person classes, or are they online, or is it a mix? And those that say it's online only, they will likely be not allowed entry into the United States and asked to return home. So this is a real worry. And what's an even bigger worry, I think, is for colleges, is something that's in terms of safety. There's a double-edged sword here. There's the safety issues for new students that are coming in for their first time to a college campus that are excited about that opportunity. They've been dreaming about coming to campus, that campus, for a couple of years at least. And I've been thinking about what that's going to look like, and certainly the reality is it's very different than what it was potentially going to look like in their mind. But we're seeing some recent surveys. Simpson Scarborough recently did, and this is for domestic students primarily. But the feeling of incoming freshmen to four-year institutions, up to 40% of incoming freshmen are highly likely not to attend, because they're nervous about, if not them, their parents are certainly nervous about what the health situation is going to be. And if they've been seeing the news at some of the colleges, that North Carolina, Oklahoma State, Notre Dame, Michigan State, just yesterday, have made the decision to go online this fall after they started the fall term, orientation, and first week of classes, all of that. And what happens? Boom. Students, shockingly, college students, like to get together and like to party and like to have these social interactions where they're not socially distant. They're not wearing masks. Even in dorm rooms, dorm parties that were going on, 10, 15 students in a room not wearing masks. And you wonder how that came to be, that all these students start getting diagnosed with COVID. And then there's 123 at one institution, 150 at another, 23 in a sorority house. And all of these things happen where, as if the college students are acting like there's nothing, the pandemic isn't happening, that there isn't still concern, that they're 18, 19, and they're impervious, they're immortal, nothing can affect them. And the reality is something different. We obviously don't get into all the individual cases of whether these students are asymptomatic or mild symptoms, whatever it might be on the low end of the scale. But there are inevitably going to be deaths as a result of this. And how that gets interpreted by students that are on campus, these nervous freshmen who may not be enrolling will be obviously will be saying, well, I made the right decision, if they don't, because of what's happening at some of these college campuses. But it's not just the current students, it's returning students. And another survey put out by Pulse, College Pulse, last week, 13% of the 1,500 students that were interviewed said they have no trust at all in their institutions to protect them. And that decisions that should be made, whether classes are online or in person, should be made by the professors, not by the universities. So that there seemed to be that kind of an opinion for returning students, at least. So I think it's, frankly, college students saying that they don't trust their institutions to make the right decisions is a little bit disingenuous, because the data is clearly showing so far that institutions that have reopened in person, students can't be trusted with their own health and safety at these campuses that have been where they are now shutting down and going online only. So it's a very tricky situation, and certainly there's no blame that we're talking about here. It's really an issue of, well, what are we doing? What are we doing here to really prevent this from becoming a situation worse than it already is? So there's a lot of issues here, obviously, with reopening now, and we're seeing kind of the worst case scenario being realized at a number of these schools that had made the decision to be even hybrid, where you have some in-person, mostly online, but having students physically coming back to campus and what that looks like. Those that are making the switch now are saying you can't even come and live in our residence halls in some cases. So that's producing some really extra concerns that certainly international students certainly don't want to be dealing with at this point in their journeys. And frankly, the colleges that are probably are going to see long term the best results out of this scenario, out of the worst possible scenario of not having international students on campus this fall, long term. If you made that decision early on, back in May, when it's becoming clear that embassies and consulates weren't opening up in a timely fashion to allow students to go get visas to eventually be able to come into the country, when you were seeing that happen, when you were seeing a lot of the travel trends with restrictions being thrown up in terms of who would or would not be able to actually get on flights and be able to come. We've seen last couple of weeks airlines putting up flags saying, well, we want anybody who's going to fly with us to have a negative COVID test result within the last week before we'll let them on a plane. And that's outside of what the government restrictions are and immigration policy just changes might be. So there's been so much that's happened in the last 3 or 4 months, but the writing clearly was on the wall back in May, And a lot of folks like myself were saying, do yourself a favor, go tell your international students to defer or start online with you in the fall, because that's the only realistic option for them to be able to attend in the current year or in a future semester. So those colleges that have made those decisions to be primarily online, where international students wouldn't be able to come in anyway, those are ones that are going to survive this, I think, a lot better when it comes to restarting their international recruitment options. So there's a lot that still will happen over the next few weeks, but as a country, we haven't handled COVID-19 well. Individual states have made their decisions on mask orders, and many of those are still in place in many of these states. But the reality is, on campus, those aren't being enforced. Students go off campus to parties. They're going to do what they want to do and what they've always done, and they're going to party and have a good time. And the majority right now aren't protecting themselves. And that's something that is going to have knock-on consequences for institutions, as you're seeing with so many of the schools, big name schools, that have made that decision this week after opening in person to go online. So we'll see what happens from here. But last question I want to touch on today is one we've talked about in the past, and that's our relationship with China in the United States. And how are we defining that relationship these days is kind of the next evolution. We've talked in the past about Confucius Institutes, and this first part of the story certainly covers that. You may not have seen it, but the State Department this past week has designated the D.C. office for China's Confucius Institutes, kind of a clearinghouse for their operations in the United States, to now be declared a foreign mission. Now, what does that mean? So it's like an embassy or a consulate. It's that level. It's not obviously issuing visas or passports or anything like that, but it's considered Chinese sovereign ground. And the purpose of that, foreign entity, a foreign mission, is to promote advancing Beijing's global propaganda and malign influence campaign on U.S. campuses and K-12 classrooms. That's straight from the State Department. For what they're calling it, what it is, it's advancing Beijing's global propaganda and intending to have, according to the State Department, a negative influence campaign on U.S. campuses and K-12 education. So this decision doesn't directly impact campuses who have Confucius Institutes, and we've been talking for months on the number of closures that have been seen in the United States and around the world, frankly, of these Confucius Institutes. There are currently 75 Confucius Institutes in the United States and 65 on U.S. campuses. So those are the 65. 45 U.S. colleges have closed their Confucius Institutes in the last 2 years. And increasingly, and Karen Fisher makes this point in her Global Latitudes newsletter that came out Monday, how today you wouldn't see a U.S. college signing an agreement to open a Confucius Institute on their campus. The environment has gotten quite toxic. The relationship has gotten quite toxic, obviously, between governments. So to do something as significant as try and open a Confucius Institute, knowing the implications, knowing that certainly the track record they have in the United States, it really impacts a lot of different things about how our country views China. And certainly the pandemic has also brought along some other negative implications with China. Not only as the president likes to remind us, the virus originated in China, but also anyone who's ordered the products online realizes more and more, if you didn't already know, that how much of what we order comes from China, and might have seen delays on things they might normally have ordered and gotten in a fairly speedy process, how extra long things, non-essential items, have taken to get because they're coming from China and are getting held up in customs and delays and on entry. So there's a whole lot of impacting this relationship with China. We've talked to the last week about WeChat and TikTok and what that means. And a colleague of mine shared this with me over the weekend, how a colleague I've known for years has been a career foreign service officer in State Department. He has indicated that a lot of the national security concerns behind WeChat and TikTok are real, and that's the part of it is driven by the national intelligence or national security laws that have been passed over the last few years by President Xi. A lot of them that require that, yes, you can operate to Chinese companies, you can operate wherever you want, as long as the host countries allow you in, you can do whatever you want in the world. But if we come asking for data, you're going to give it to us, and you have no choice but to give it to us. So the kind of control that the government has over private entities, governments, or private organizations and companies in China is absolute. There is very little that anybody can do about it. And so that's where the security, national security concerns are about WeChat and TikTok and other platforms that are currently on the president's hit list. So we'll see what happens with those. We'll certainly keep you updated on that impact. Obviously, several of these platforms are also used in a recruitment of international students from China. So we'll certainly have more to say on that in the coming weeks and months as more develops, certainly at the end of that 45-day period that the president in his executive order related to TikTok and WeChat. So we'll see what happens with those, and we'll have more on that later. But so there are real national security concerns here that the government has with not just TikTok, WeChat, but also Huawei. We already know about that one and the impact that's having, but other Chinese government or Chinese organizations, companies that are by law in China are subservient to the government and must give up data when asked. So that's something that we'll certainly keep an eye on and how those programs develop. Certainly would have a huge impact in the United States for any Chinese Americans and Chinese students trying to keep in touch with relatives in China and any universities they're trying to recruit as well. So maybe we'll have a great firewall or VPN wall to allow Americans to use those services to recruit. We'll see. And to communicate with China. But more on that as the days and weeks progress. But for now, thank you for joining us. And those special shout out to those that are listening on the podcast. And we appreciate you making us a part of your regular listening. So until next week, have a great day.